Hey, this is Joe Harris, writer of the X-Files comics. You're listening to the X-Cast.
Welcome to the X-Cast, looking at the X-Files. I'm obviously not Tony, I'm Darren. I'm stepping in to do a very special episode in which we're going to talk a little bit about the X-Files comic books that were published by Topps starting late in the second season, and the particular comics that we're talking about ran through, I think, to the end of the third and maybe even to the start of the fourth. They are the comic book run that was overseen by writer Stefan Petrucca and also artist Charles Adlard. They are, being entirely honest, some of my favourite tie-in comics that I've ever read. And I'm actually very chuffed that I managed to invite Stefan on to talk about them. So hello, Stefan.
Thank you. Hello, Darren.
Pleasure to have you on. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to us about this, because this is something I've wanted to talk about for quite a while. I only discovered the comics recently through the reprints that were released by IDW, I believe. And they're just fantastic. They read very, very well. And I was reading them as I was watching the show as well. So I was reading them while watching, say, the second and third seasons. And they're sort of a wonderful companion piece to go with them. But I'm just sort of curious with regards to how it came about, how, like, the X-Files, they went to Topps. I'm Irish, as my accent probably gives away, my wonderful American-sounding accent. But Topps, as I understand it, were a publisher in the States. They mostly did like collectibles and baseball cards, if I remember correctly. So, and I think Mars Attacks cards and stuff like that. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yes, that's correct. And then Jim Solikarup, who a friend of mine since I was 10, moved there from Marvel. I think he'd been at Marvel as an editor, a big editor there. He used to do the X-Men and Spider-Man and such, to helm their line of comic books, which started pretty much as licensed material. And it was the first time I worked with Jim professionally, and he started asking me to do a couple of things, like they were reviving an old version of the Kirbyverse, not the DC titles, but some things like Captain Victory that hadn't been only had a couple of issues published by Independence, and they did the licensed version of Coppola's Dracula film. And then I wrote I didn't do that any of that, but I started working for him basically on Duckman, which was the licensed version of the cartoon show starring the guy from Seinfeld, Alexander. Larry Alexander? David Alexander?
Jason Alexander, sorry.
Jason Alexander, thank you very much.
If we keep saying first names, we'll get there eventually.
Okay, that was fun. It was a long time ago. It was a great guy. It was a funny show. So I started doing those for him and a couple other things. And when the first episode of The X-Files came on, I was thrilled and excited about it as a big fan of the paranormal going back to when I was 10. Starting with, you know, Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken. And I thought the show had hit just the right note. So I knew Jim was looking for licensed property. So I called him up and I said, you got to get this and you got to let me write it. And apparently a couple of people had the same sort of idea, but Topps managed to get the negotiations. Originally, they were trying to have Peter David write it, but I don't know. I think he was too busy at the time. So I got the gig.
Yeah, and how wonderfully it worked out as well. I mean, one of the things about it is that this happened early in the second season. I don't know when you would have started writing it, but in terms of it was released around, I think, December in what, 1994, I think? And it was basically, it was around the time that Aubrey aired, if I have my sort of chronology vaguely right here. And it was around the time, I think, Carter was talking about, he was seeing, like, you were seeing more licensing the X-Files, you're seeing releasing the VHSs, Creation were starting to run events, like fan events and stuff like that, and you're starting to see merchandise coming out. But part of what's striking about your work that you did on the X-Files, on the comic book, is the fact that it feels at once entirely of a piece with the show, in that it's recognisably the X-Files. You have a sense of Mulder and Scully's voices, and you have a sense of the world in which they operate. But it's also something that's very particular to comic books. It's something that wouldn't... It's not like... It doesn't feel like you were writing an episode of the show that just happened to be illustrated. It felt like you were very much pitching it in terms of comic books. So I'm kind of curious, as a writer who, I believe you teach workshops in comic book writing at the moment, what was it about translating the X-Files to comic books specifically? Was there anything that was sort of particular about that?
One of the things about a lot of comic book adaptations at the time is that they tend to just try to look like the TV show. You see a lot of talking heads and things. And I wanted to try, and with Charlie Adlard, of course, wanted to try to take advantage of the comic medium. There are ways in which comics are superior to TV and ways in which they're inferior. Like if you're watching an actor, they can say the a million different ways and evoke a million different emotions. But with comic books, you're the only one reading the text, so the voice is essentially yours. The other advantage to comics is that there's no budget. It costs just as much to show the plains of Tunguska, Siberia, as it does to show the inside of a house. So throughout, I was trying to take advantage of the medium strengths and try to steer a little bit away from, I guess, what would be the performances and stuff that from Duchovny and Anderson that gave the show its strength. Not that I avoided their dialogue, but it was more, I guess, geared towards someone reading it rather than hearing it would probably be the best way to say it.
And I mean, one of the things about your run is you also, first of all, your run is incredibly, like, you worked on it for 16 issues, but in those 16 issues, you also published a wealth of sort of supplementary material, including, for example, a 5-page comic in TV Guide, a 0 issue with Wizard, a 1/2 issue as well. And a lot of that stuff was done with you and Charlie Adlard. Adlard, I believe, is probably best known now. He co-created The Walking Dead with Robert Kirkman.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, in terms of the productivity and the relationship that you two had, how did that work in terms of writer and artist? So was it that you sort of, you approached the idea, you came up with the idea of pitching, like getting the X-Files as a licensed comic. Did you pick the artist or was that sort of suggested?
No. Jim found him and it was terrific. I loved working with Charlie. Some people had issues with some of his likenesses of Gillian Anderson early on, but I thought he was a fantastic artist. He was not only fast, he could produce pages, you know, on time, and which is why we were able to do a lot of those things for that first year. That probably a lot of other artists couldn't. But what he excelled at was the storytelling. He knew how to tell stories visually and bless him, understood my scripts.
I was going to say, and the mood of those pages as well, because it's interesting you should mention the likenesses being an issue, but it captures the mood of like the Vancouver era very well. It's very like,
yes.
It's very inky, it's very moody, it's very atmospheric.
Yeah. A lot of Charlie's works is, and he had a nice use of, he probably thinks he's evolved since. And I think looks back on some of this as, not embarrassing, but earlier work. But I think he did a fantastic job, particularly with the blacks and the way he worked with just the shapes and the storytelling. I remember one little sequence of panels that was just it was my idea I did full script, so I described each panel. And there was a sequence where a burning piece of paper changes into a flying helicopter over the Arctic that he just did beautifully. He was also very, even though... the likenesses per se may have been problematic for some, he did some incredible facial expressions. Remembering one from the mail order bride from the Home of the Brave, the last couple of issues, that really just captured her ambivalence perfectly.
Well, I mean, there's even, like, when you mention his faces, I'm thinking of, like, the beat panels that you would do in, say, Feelings of Unreality, where you'd have a page where it's just Mulder and Scully staring at each other in these widescreen panels, and there's so much,
yes,
like, communicated in that, which, you know, in any other comic would seem like decompression, sort of waste of space, but it's used so perfectly. And actually, I want to sort of talk about that in terms of, like, storytelling and narrative, because one of the things I like about reading your comics, and obviously we'll talk a little bit about the structure in the first year, where you did, like, 12 stories, you know, you did, like, I think 9 stories over 12 issues that were all revealed to be one mega arc. But when I read those issues, they read very well. They're not overly dense or overly text heavy, but they feel rich, and like each individual issue feels very contained and very well structured, and very, so there's a lot of attention paid to it. How do you find in terms of like structuring, telling a complete story often within a single issue, and finding like a clear beginning, middle and end, but also like finding room for those beats and for those little moments in there?
Thank you, first of all. I do a lot of outlining up front, but a lot of the trick is, as you say, trying to find the space to make each moment kind of come to life. So there, it's practically 2 phases. I'll first go through and just do kind of a rough, you know, this is going to go on this page, this is going to go on this page. But then I'll go back and find a moment, like, and I remember the one you're talking about with from Feelings of Reality, where there are some beats where they're just kind of staring at each other, and then someone speaks, which I think actually comes very close to their performances in the show. And if I see an opportunity for that, I'll wind up expanding it and then trying to condense some of the stuff that's more, you know, exposition-y, I guess I would say. And there's a lot of exposition in the X-Files, that, and that's always a bane for all sorts of writers. So part of the trick is to find something else going on, something to hook it into the moment so it feels more real rather than just two people talking about the story.
Can I ask, in terms of comic book storytelling, or even just storytelling in general, what would be your sort of influences? Because I remember reading this and feeling that it was very akin to, and this is maybe just me as somebody with a very limited knowledge of like American comic books, but it felt very much like what Vertigo were doing around the same time. So stuff like, say, Gaiman's writing or stuff like Morrison's writing. And maybe it was Adler's art as well, but it had this sort of like almost experimental, sort of moody, like intellectual quality to it that was sort of playful and kind of meta and self-aware, but which was also very structured on like these bold philosophical constructs, which, you know, are very key to the X-Files, for like consciousness expansion and sort of mind-blowing stuff that was happening that was akin to what I think Morrison was doing on The Invisibles and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, The Invisibles, Morrison and Gaiman, I think it relatively just started out. I don't think The Invisibles was out yet.
Oh no, The Invisibles was later, yes, sir.
No, that's perfectly okay. I think the Vertigo audience is sort of the right idea for the feel of the comic book and the show. At the time, I think even Gaiman, I think Sandman had started coming out, and he hadn't quite peaked yet. He was doing really well on it. My influences personally are, part of them are literary, part of them in comic books. Alan Moore, I followed for years and still adore him. And then you go back to things like Jim Starlin or Stan Lee. But in terms of reading, like I said, I'd read a lot of paranormal material, Philip K. Dick on the science fiction side, and things like, what am I thinking of, the Illuminati trilogy, which was satirical by Robert Anton Wilson, and that sort of stuff. I was also very steeped in Dostoevsky and a couple of things like that, Kafka, that had that sort of heavier, or even not heavier necessarily, but more literary feel to it. That's one of the reasons I love Moore, and later enjoyed Morrison and Neil Gaiman, because I felt like we had read the same books, so to speak.
Actually, it's funny that you should mention like Dick and for example Kafka and stuff like that, because when I read your work, there's a lot of that sort of bend in this sort of sense of reality and the question of what is truly real and what is substantial and stuff like that, that I think in many ways sort of prefigures a lot of what you would see sort of seeping into like late 90s culture with films like, say, obviously The Matrix, but like Dark City, The Truman Show, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was that a conscious thing? Did you sit down when you were like assigned to the X-Files and say, well, I want to deal with, say, the theme of reality in these first 12 issues that I have, and then maybe expand in the following four? Or was it just something that came naturally to you as you were writing?
Well, for me, it came out of the X-Files. You know, I think we were 6 months ahead, so I think the first season was still on when I started writing it, or it was just coming towards the end of the first season. And the early episodes asked that question. You know, they hadn't yet confirmed that the paranormal was real. They were trying to play it right down the middle of the line, which creates the question, what's reality, and how do you figure out what it is? So Scully was the supposed scientist and Mulder the believer. As the show progressed, it became obvious that, yeah, the aliens and everything are real. But I actually preferred those early stories that, you know, played it right down the middle. I always loved things like Turn of the Screw by Henry James, where it's a ghost story, but it doesn't matter whether there are actual ghosts or not. The end results psychologically and emotionally are exactly the same. And hitting that note, getting into why people see Bigfoot or think they see Bigfoot and the kinds of reasoning they use to get there was what fascinated me. So it was kind of like ways of thinking. And I tried to reflect that in the comic. I also admit I had a bias towards Scully. I think I wrote one of the few rare stories where she's actually right. But one of the reasons I did that was because she had been less developed in the TV show. So I felt like it was more fertile, interesting ground in the comics.
And actually, one of the things I like about your portrayal of Scully, and it comes up again towards the end of, say, that first year, is where Scully basically has this conversation with Mulder, and she makes the case that, you know, her position is not rigidly and diametrically opposed to Mulder in like on fundamental grounds. It's more in terms of like Scully's belief in science is the argument that Mulder's like belief should be justifiable, and that it is possible to expand the boundaries of science in such a way that will encompass what Mulder believes, which is, I think, a very interesting way of approaching Scully and kind of reconciling her, which I think that, you know, maybe the first season of the TV show sort of struggled a little bit with. And I thought it was kind of, ultimately they went a different direction where it was, you know, you had that sort of dichotomy between skeptic and believer. But I think that what you did was kind of interesting in that you said that actually maybe that they both fall under the same roof. Maybe it's possible to have like a scientific understanding that does explain what Mulder believes, which I think was interesting.
Well, if those things are real, of course there's a scientific explanation. We just don't know what it is yet. And I think, you know, the skeptic kind of gets the bad end of the stick lately because most people use the term just to mean a non-believer. And that's not what a skeptic is at all. Someone who doesn't believe in UFOs as aliens is just as much a believer as someone who does. A skeptic is someone who just wants evidence to before they decide, so to speak. Mulder, for his emotional reasons, accepts things based on faith. That allows him to make these intuitive leaps like, oh, of course it's a giant earthworm, you know, or whatever. Whereas, you know, Scully looks at the data, or at least the way I tried to portray her in the comics, and then makes the conclusion. And until you know what it is, anything is possible, but some things based on history and your experience are just more likely, if that makes sense.
No, it very much does. In terms of like mapping out, say, because I think it's safe to say that maybe your run breaks down into two portions. So there's the first 12 issues, which deal with this sort of overarching like Aquarius mythology sort of stuff, which is interesting because it deals with sort of what you would expect from an X-Files mythology sort of story, while also poking and prodding at it a bit. In terms of like mapping out those first 12 issues, what was it that happened? Did you basically say I want to do a mythology story, or was it something that sort of came from like, well, I want to pick apart a mythology story? Like, there are elements of it that feel like at points you're using, say, the cigarette smoking man, and he sort of drifts in and out of it. And there's a question of like, how does this conspiracy relate to the other X-Files, sort of to the one that you're seeing on TV at the same time? When you were writing like 6 months ahead of what was happening on television, how did you figure that out? Like, how did that work?
That was one of the big issues, and where all that sort of stuff comes from, a lot of it, is that I'm writing in the dark. I don't know what's going to happen on the show. They never told us what was going to happen on the show, except for one point where we were asked not to do a story involving Native Americans, but that was after I had written the Hidden Cities of Alaska story.
And Science is the Mind, yeah.
So that was, so that was weird. So, at the time, everybody was like, the truth is out there, and they thought they were going to get the truth at some point. So a lot of it is me playing with that and deciding. I think early on I thought that, you know, whatever conspiracy they have in the show doesn't have to be the only conspiracy going on. So I gave myself free rein to come up with a conspiracy that kind of had nothing to do with, you know, that was sort of stood alongside it, or what what I was guessing they were trying to do with the show. One of the reasons the smoking man drifts in and out is they were very worried, based on the comments we got back, about saying something that would contradict the show. So they decided the comics should have their own informer, their own version of the Smoking Man, which I think it did. I introduced a character at some point. I forgot his name, but he was basically a stand-in for the Smoking Man. So that's why he drifts in and out of those first 12 issues. And the 12 issues themselves were, I was thinking, you know, I got the job, I made a list of about 100, literally 100 paranormal topics that I thought would be good seeds for stories. And as we went along, I picked my favorite. And one of the ongoing themes is memory and whether we can trust it or not and how it can be influenced. So I decided to make that sort of in the background as, you know, the source of the conspiracy, or at least my little conspiracy aside from that. But in that context, I told those stories separately, not really thinking necessarily when I came up with them how they connected to the larger conspiracy, but then doing these little tie-in things that they were, like the assassination attempts from number two were connected. So the conclusion was always there, but it wasn't, might have been more planned out than the TV show, but it wasn't very specifically structured that way. I structured each story individually.
It reads fascinatingly because you get the seeding in the early stories, and then around, say, I think the 7th issue or whatever, it starts to suddenly circle around back to itself. Now, I had imagined when I was reading that you'd always sort of plan for this to fit together. But when you talk about it there, is it that, like, they started, you know, you had a rough idea of what you're doing, and then things started coming together in a way that felt more natural that you sort of built upon? Or did you plan everything in advance?
Well, it's somewhere in between the two. I mean, I knew where it was going, but how you get there, You know, you try to make each moment feel alive, and I did little tie-ins to the conclusion along the way. But the thing is, once you start dealing with themes like that, and once you have, you know, the conspiracy theories, the government, the memory evidence, all those sorts of things, basically the conflict implies its own sort of conclusion. So once you, if you have a strong enough metaphorical or thematic link going through it, it feels more like a whole. I mean, I never made any of it up as I went along, per se, although I probably did that a lot more with this than I did with other things. Partly because I was watching the show at the time, and if they did something completely different, I'd have to revise it as I went along the way, and they would have to approve it, which they were very antsy about since the third issue, because the third issue was about
Samantha, wasn't it? I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I went to great lengths to convince them that this didn't necessarily have anything to do with what really happened to Samantha, but they were still at first they didn't want her mentioned at all. And they asked me to rewrite the script without her, but my Jim Solkrep, the editor, Tops, went to bat on that one, and that stayed. So it was a very tense and exciting relationship as I went along.
I'm kind of tempted to ask, while you're discussing sort of the relationship with 1013, I know, for example, the annual that you wrote, which was Hallowed Eve, I believe. By the way, I love the wordplay in your titles, just on a purely sort of, you know, appreciating the run note. I think you had, like, Tiptoeing Through the Tulpas is another one that I like.
Oh, thank you.
Trey Panning Opera.
Thank you.
Really, really, I'm a big fan of wordplay, and the titles are fantastic. But I remember Hallowed Eve, I think you mentioned at one stage that you were considering possibly using the character of Eve from the first season episode.
That's where the story came from. That is where the story came from. That's how I wrote the original script. But they didn't want Eve in it.
So you had to rewrite and take it out?
Yeah, basically.
Wow. But yeah, so basically, as you're writing the 12 issues, can you think of anything, for example, you were talking about how you were watching the show and waiting to see when they were zigging and zagging and what you'd have to change. Was there anything that you did have to change, like, that didn't come as a note, that just sort of, as you were watching it, the show took a direction or a turn, and you were like, okay, well, this kind of throws what I'm planning to do out, or this sort of, you know, this isn't what I anticipated, so I have to rework that slightly. Can you remember any of that? I know this is 20 years ago now at this stage.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, and I'd have to remember the specific episodes. That is tough. I mean, I do remember the notes I got from the scripts I was writing, but I remember, like, watching, like, biting my fingers several times, hoping they weren't doing something that was coming out in the comic book that would be out in a month, you know, the one that had already been written. I remember that sort of thing a lot. But one of the advantages for me was that X-Files was one of those shows that, like, pretended it was going to have a conclusion, you know, like, not Twin Peaks, but Battlestar Galactica or something like that. You know, we have a plan, but there really wasn't one.
Yeah.
But in those first seasons, it really looked like they were headed somewhere. But the more, you know, the bigger the show got, they didn't want to, like, do any massive conclusions. So they got vaguer about what the conspiracy was, which made it easier in some ways for me for that first year and a half, because I could be specific off in the corner.
Yeah, it gave you nooks and crannies in which you could write.
Yeah, yeah. You fill the nooks and crannies, and there was no definitive answer that I could contradict. Until you got to the, you know, the shape-shifting aliens and the ooze. I don't remember when their Tunguska episode came out.
It did much later. But much later.
Yeah, much later than mine. They actually wound up doing a lot of stuff that I covered in the comic. And to be clear, I don't blame them or harbor any grudges about it. The timing of firing me was unfortunate, but it was their show. They were exploring new territory, and they had just started getting into licensing. I think the comic book was actually one of the first licensed things they did, other than, I think, a leather jacket or something. And it was blowing up, or, you know, exploding in its popularity from a niche to, you know, the mass culture right around the same time the comic was coming out and finding its feet.
I want to sort of ask about that, actually, because I remember, like, reading it, and it's interesting reading it now in hindsight, having watched the show and reading it versus when it was coming out month to month, because there is a lot of stuff in there that is kind of parallel development, would probably be, I would assume, is how it developed, where you have stuff that you do in the show that are in the comic that then is sort of, it isn't that it's a direct lift, but in some ways it's like echo later on. So you mentioned, obviously, you do a Tunguska story like Firebird, or not, which is really, really great. But you even do stuff like, for example, there's a lot of your writing on, say, disremembrance of things past. I think your second issue, which is just phenomenal, which in many ways sort of prefigures, I think, a lot of the stuff that, say, Darren Morgan or Glenn Morgan would do, or even like stuff when you're doing Home of the Brave, or even the opening of Silent Cities of the Mind, where you're writing about, say, militias in America in the 90s, which was a big thing. It was very, like, the movement was growing and there was a lot of concern about it. And obviously this was before Oklahoma, I think. But then you got, like, the show in its fourth season would embrace a lot of those ideas. It would do, like, its Tunguska episode would also feature, for example, militias. Or, you know, they would do an episode with, like, I think on Requited, which is the guy who can turn invisible and that sort of stuff. And I got the sense reading it that it was just a sense that you were very much in tune with the X-Files, that it was like you were picking stuff that would occur to, you know, that would be very X-Filesy material. But, like, do you think there was a link there or a development there, or do you think it was just that you were very much of a moment with the show, that it was like, you know, that the X-Files was eventually going to have to do this stuff, and it just so happened that you got there first? Or do you think that maybe there was an influence there?
You mean me influencing them?
Yeah.
Or them influencing me. I think what you said towards the middle there was pretty accurate. I mean, we're both dealing with the paranormal, and there's X number of subjects. So as you go along, you're gonna hit all of them, and I was hitting my favorites in the context of the comic, and they were, you know, moving along in a different way with the show. But of course, the longer the show stayed on, the longer, you know, the more topics they would have to hit. So eventually, we'd have to be in the same place in some ways.
Just in terms of the work that you did, so obviously I mentioned they're kind of two halves of the one. Well, they're not really halves because they're not the same length as one another. But after you did that sort of big, like, Aquarius mythology story that ran 12 episodes or 12 issues, you did these four issues that followed. So between, I think, 13 and 16. And I mean, I'd also include, I think, the Afterflight, the graphic novel, which you may talk about a little bit later on, in there as well, where you moved away, I think, from conventional X-Files stories in some ways, or maybe they were conventional in like their trappings, in that they did feature aliens, for example, they did feature mysterious crashes, they did feature like sentient computer programs. But the tone, reading those final four issues, feels very different. It feels very melancholy in places. There's a sense that it's almost like, you know, those old Twilight Zone episodes where it turns out that, you know, the monster is man and stuff.
Yeah.
Was it a conscious shift after you did those 12 issues, or was it just, you know, well, I've done this big mythology story I want to do. I just want to do four standalones, and these are the four that occurred to me.
It's interesting you say melancholy, but I mean, you know, the biggest monster is man, I think, was a theme from the first issue. But the fact is, after I completed the first conspiracy, I wasn't allowed to do extended stories anymore. So I had to do the standalone. And in a way, they were, since I think the third issue, they'd been trying to fire me. So by the 12th issue, part of that melancholy is probably a lot to do with all the fact that everybody loved what I was doing in the comic book world, but Chris Carter and the production company were increasingly unhappy with me, which made it increasingly frustrating. It wasn't like, the Buffy comic book has the writers from the show working on it. Other comic books are more integrated with the writers of the TV show. This wasn't like that at all. I never heard from them. I never actually spoke to anyone from the show until roughly the end. They were and Topps was getting notes to an editor who would pass them on to me, and the editor didn't watch the show. So we were playing this weird, well, eventually he did, but we were playing this weird telephone game. I mean, it's much easier now because I think comics are in some ways, you know, not that we were disrespected for being a comic book, but the zeitgeist is much more approving of the connection between Hollywood and comics, and there's much more integration. This was like, you know, I'm listening to a tin can on one end about what I, you know, don't do this, don't do that. Mulder can't be so funny.
Really?
was one of the early comments I got from my editor. And I don't know exactly what the note was, but that's what came through to my end. So that was very frustrating. You were asking about the melancholy mood of the last four. So I was stuck with doing standalone stories. Home of the Brave was two-parter, but it was still just a single story. So that's why I did those. And I, you know, I like I said, I had 100 ideas from the start, so I picked the best four stories. And yeah, my mood was probably darker by then. And there is sort of a dystopian quality to the X-Files from the get-go. You're not in control of your life. Other things are, you know, forces you cannot conceive of are moving things around for you. And, you know, that probably came through perhaps more so in the last four issues. I enjoyed Home of the Brave a lot. I thought it was a good swan song, so to speak.
It's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful piece, particularly the closing, like Thank the you. Resolution of it, which is like, almost like a too good for this sinful earth kind of conclusion.
I swiped that from a science fiction story from the 1950s that this was basically an homage to, and I'm sorry I can't remember the name of the story, but it was much simpler. It was like these people encountering these aliens in the woods, and they were with this this woman who, you know, the men were just sort of ignoring her throughout, and in the end she runs off to go with the aliens because it has to be better than this. It was kind of like a one-line joke. The Home of the Brave looks at the dark side of what the X-Files is, what conspiracy theories, unfounded conspiracy theories, and how they motivate these militias and such, and a lot of the underbelly of the ignorant side of the United States, if you want to call it that, our darker side.
Yeah. I mean, that's something you were very much, again, I mentioned earlier, like you being ahead of the show in some respects. Because I think the show grappled with that in its fourth season, say, with Carter doing stuff with the militia, or having like Mulder have this sort of crisis of faith about what was real and what was not. And in some ways, it's kind of funny that you did all this stuff in many ways before the show did, and kind of did it very cleverly and very, you know, insightfully, and very sort of like playful. And I don't want to, like, the word deconstruct, I think, is overused in terms of like discussing pop culture and discussing art and stuff. But was there a sense that when you were doing this, you were sort of like, you were picking at like some of the assumptions of the X-Files. So for example, I particularly like, say, Falling, which is this really, really brutal, harrowing story about like Mulder and Scully going to a small town to investigate what might be a UFO crash, but quickly devolves into this sort of Lord of the Flies type situation about children and guns. And it's really odd, and it has this really crushing line where it's like, are the aliens, you know, sometimes the aliens show up and sometimes the aliens are us. And there's this sort of sense that people are as weird and wonderful and sort of dark and twisted as any horror story you could tell. And it kind of, it's really, really well constructed. And it fits with the other two as well. Because I think, was it the only one player or one player only?
One player, yeah, it was one player only, and then Falling, and then Home of the Brave, I think.
Yeah, all have these twists where you have an X-Files element, but it turns out the X-Files element is not the monster at all. The X-Files element just happens to be there. The monster is really what people do themselves, which is a very clever way of telling an X-Files story, I think. And I mean, there are examples from the show of it, but it's kind of fun, interesting that you got three of those back-to-back sort of so late in your run.
Yeah, in part it's the theme that I was playing with from the beginning, that we're the monsters, that, you know, it goes back to the same reason I like things like The Innocents or Turn of the Screw, where it can go either way. And the flip side of that is that I think what the last couple of stories start to explore is why beliefs, without question, are bad. That that they have negative reproduction. So it's deconstruction is a heady term. I think when you look at the themes and ideas you're playing with, you always get under the hood if you're doing your job and pulling those out in different ways. But again, my attitude toward the X-Files at the time, those are the last two stories particularly are about why, you know, thinking aliens are great is not necessarily a good thing in the real world.
There is, and I mean, some of the stuff reads, and again, it's kind of interesting talking about it now, because these have been sort of republished and reprinted. I think they're republished and reprinted the first time around about 2014-2015, when IDW bought the license kind of leading into the revival, which I think ties into what you're saying earlier about comics being more respected or mainstream now. Like, you had Carter, for example, like writing introductions and giving interviews about how Joe Harris's like season 10 was now canon, in inverted commas, even though it very quickly became not canon as soon as the revival sort of came about. I feel like you can empathize in some respects with that sort of sharp left turn, but it is kind of interesting to go back and to read them now, because there is And I think maybe this is something that speaks to the X-Files itself. There's an element of reading your comics with regards to the aspect of, like, cult memory being intangible. And, like, there's a really great thing that you do. You mentioned the third issue that was so controversial with 1013, the one with Samantha. And it seems quite clever. I'm not sure if you did... I suspect you did this intentionally, but I don't want to assume. But you did something like you played with the idea that, for example, the account of Samantha's abduction in, I think, Conduit in the first season was very different from the account that was actually seen at the start of the second season with Glenn Morgan.
Yeah, that was conscious.
That was very conscious.
That was me trying to fix... That was me trying to fix that.
But fixing it in a very clever way, because then it allows you to, as you said, get under the hood and get to the idea of, like, what is memory and how does memory define us and shape us? And does memory have any relation to truth? And does that then tie back to reality in any way, shape, or form? It's kind of interesting reading that now, because you mentioned about, like, the dark underbelly of the United States. I think you're right when you say stuff like The Home of the Brave. The Home of the Brave reads, like, I imagine it was very uncomfortable at the time when you had the militia movement sort of coming off the 90s, but now in the context of, say, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, it reads particularly, I don't want to say presciently or whatever, but it reads, it's even more uncomfortable, if that makes sense, than I imagined it being when it was first written. It's kind of interesting. Do you think that maybe, do you think the runs age well? Have you read your old issues? Have you sort of looked at them? Did you get, like, copies from IDW? And, like, how do you think they stack up? Are you proud of the work that you did? Like, is there, you know, how does it fit together?
I did get the hardcover versions from IDW, and I think they did a terrific job. I wish I had warned them to flip two pages that had been printed in reverse order from Trepanning Opera, but that's okay. And yeah, I flipped through them. I enjoy the art. I don't actually sit down and reread them because I wrote them, and that's kind of weird. So it's really just occasionally I'll see a line and think highly of myself, or I'll see another line and think, oh, I wish I'd changed that. But I think we have a tendency to think that whatever, you know, culturally, that whatever we're experiencing right now is somehow new. And those militias, in their way, were just as scary back then as they are now. It's just, in a way, it feels different because we had 8 years of Obama and a sense as a society that we had progressed more than we actually had. My feeling is we were just in kind of a bubble. And a lot of people are actually seeing what a lot of us are like, really like, and have been all along now. So I don't know that I was prescient as much as the same issues are still around. I mean, if you go back to people talk about how the United States is divided politically now. If you go back to the 60s, we were much more divided. We were on much more different sides. And there was much more violence going on. Kent State and a variety of other things in terms of the protests. So I think the issue is that we think we've changed a lot, but we really haven't. It's more of a three steps forward, two steps back thing. So I remain very proud of it, and I'm glad people still enjoy it. And I think any good writing hits those notes in a way that lasts longer, you know, rather than, you know, tying it to, I don't have a comparison for how it doesn't work, but part of art is to communicate something you see in yourself that a lot of other people can relate to. And the better you do it, the more people relate to it, and the longer it lasts.
I will finally ask about Afterflight, which is something of a, like, a belated coda to your run, because you wrote those 16 issues and then you departed. I think you mentioned that you were fired basically afterwards.
Yes.
Was it, or were you fired, or was it just that it became so difficult that you left?
Nope. I was fired.
Okay. I'm very sorry about that. That's a massive loss on their part. But
thank you. Was that 2 weeks after my first daughter was born?
Oh, okay, I'm very sorry. I'm particularly sorry, but it all worked out very well.
It's not your fault, Aaron.
I feel like it is, but no. It worked out quite well, because, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about what you've done since in a moment.
Sure.
But the last piece of X-Files stuff that you wrote for Tops was the graphic novel, or the last piece that was published was the graphic novel Afterflight, which was illustrated by Jill Thompson. I believe you actually wrote that not relatively early, but you wrote that several months before the end of your involvement with that. And it just took years to come out, because I think it came out during the fifth season, if my chronology here is correct. And it wasn't meant as a capsule or anything like that. It was just meant to be similar to the annual or the stuff that you'd done, so for, say, Wizard or for TV Guide. It was just a companion piece. It wasn't like you were sort of putting a stamp on it.
Yeah, no, my mother-in-law had dementia at the time. So a lot of the feelings, you know, my wife and her family and myself were having at the time were sort of reflected in the in that story. So that's where that really came from.
It's a very beautiful piece as well. And Jill Thompson's artwork, which I believe was controversial, may have possibly contributed to the delay.
Yeah, I love Jill Thompson, and I love her work, and I love what she did with the comic, and I think what happened to her work on that was terrible for her. They kept sending it back because they didn't like the likenesses, and finally actually had someone else redraw the faces, which I think is horrific. I mean, I think, you know, on a PR level, I vaguely understand it. But when you've got a huge universe like Star Trek or Buffy or, and the X-Files is certainly up there among them, you can loosen up a little and let people do their interpretations, you know, where you can get across the essence of someone without necessarily looking exactly like Gillian Anderson or David Duchovny. And Jill also, I think, tended to put herself into the comics a bit, so her original Scully may have looked a bit like Jill. But
it is, and it's interesting, because, I mean, it's funny that you should talk about the difficulties that, like, you had and the reaction that I think 1013 had initially to the likenesses. There's an issue, there's a couple of issues later on in John Rosen's run, which I think are the remote control issues, which were the last issues illustrated by Charles Adlard. And you can actually tell looking at the artwork that the faces have been done, I believe, by Gordon Purcell. So you have this weird sort of strange structuring of artwork, which doesn't at all, like, it doesn't look like a comic book should, because you have this intense photo likeness. Gordon Purcell is one of the best photo likeness artists working in the industry. He's done a lot of work with, say, Star Trek, for example, in the 80s and stuff. But you have his faces then superimposed over Charlie Adlard's work, which is this wonderful sort of atmospheric sort of heavy inks work. And it just doesn't work at all. It's really distracting. It's like watching like 90s CGI, except on a comic book page. And it's strange that the obsession with likenesses was so intense, because it's, you know, it's an X-Files comic book on the cover with a tall man and a red-haired woman. I mean, there's no chance the audience is going to wonder who these two characters are in this panel claiming to be from the FBI. It's it's very jarring, and it's really sort of strange that it should have been such a kind of a hot-button issue in terms of branding.
Well, things have loosened up a lot since, and I think one of the things they do is they hire someone who they're happy with the likenesses to start with when you're doing something with DC and Marvel. But that's what PR people do, or at least they did that a lot. I mean, I know the Star Trek comic books from DC, to get a cover approved, had to go through, for Star Trek The Next Generation, had to go through all the major characters, not just one person, but all the major characters' agents.
Really?
Like, yeah. Well, this is what I heard from an editor who worked on the series, so I can't, you know, I wouldn't state that under oath. But if you look at the books, eventually they just gave up on trying to put the characters on the cover, and they just had issues. They just had issues that had the Enterprise was the cover, yeah, with no characters.
Well, that's a creative way around that, I suppose. I suppose you could write scripts so that Mulder and Scully's face is never seen. It's just from their point of
yes.
view.
Yes, yes, yeah, that would be good. I should have done a POV thing. But early on, and I love Charlie's work. People weren't particularly fond of the way he was drawing Scully, and I can't say he did a great likeness. But early on, John Stewart had the John Stewart Show on Channel 9. It was local; it wasn't nationwide. But he had Gillian Anderson on as a guest, and this is like in the show's kind of nascent stage when it's just starting to explode. So of course everybody's nervous about it. And I watched it because I knew they had sent Stewart a copy of the comic book. I think it was the first issue of Firebird. And he holds it up and he says, there's a comic out. He shows up, you know, Kim's beautiful cover, and everybody applauds, and Gillian says, yes, that's great. And then John Stewart, who I love, decides to open it up to this splash page of Scully that I had put there, that I had written so Charlie could practice doing his likeness. and kind of didn't. And he said, but look at this artwork. This looks nothing like you. And
Okay, I can see why the likenesses became an issue.
So you can, you know, the PR people are watching this. Other people are watching it. And, you know, you can see why they started getting, you know, they were antsy from the beginning, but got more antsy in terms of their branding. So, I mean, there's always going to be that kind of conflict between, you know, commerce and art and branding and creativity. I mean, Alan Moore was not allowed to use the Charlton superhero group that DC had just purchased, but as a result, he invented Watchmen. So, I mean, that's kind of an ongoing story. And now things have gotten to the point where they're so integrated, they just figure this stuff out ahead of time. But at the time, it was, drove everybody crazy. And there were no structures in place to handle it smoothly. The X-Files was very tight about their content because it was the hugest secret in the world, finding out what's going on in X-Files. So things just evolved the way they did.
So after you finished up working with Topps on the X-Files comics, I believe you then transitioned towards prose. I a lot of your early work, as far as I'm aware, and keep my knowledge here is not great, but you did a lot of work with comics. So you did like Metaphor. It's a comic.
Metaphor.
Metaphor, yeah. Which is a great
Metaphor
title.
And Squalor.
Yeah.
Metaphor, Squalor, Lance Barnes, Postnik, Dick. I did those with First Publishing, which was pretty much how I had done a couple of aborted fill-in issues for Marvel previously, but Squalor was really how I broke in with terrific art by Tom Sutton, classic artist in comics.
And then afterwards, I think you moved into prose, or maybe you've been doing it all along, but afterwards you began publishing, you began writing sort of books like Making God, Dark Ages, and the Time Tripper series and stuff like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I tried to stay in comics. One of the things about the X-Files in terms of its audience was it wasn't the standard comic book audience. So I was known. I made a couple of top 10 writer lists here and there, but I wasn't known as a superhero writer or necessarily as, a Vertigo or Neil Gaiman type writer. I was kind of in this weird place. And I tried to get some stuff sold to Marvel and DC, but never quite, I was second in place to do Animal Man when Grant Morrison got the gig. Or I think, no, I may, I'm sorry, it may have been whoever wrote it after Grant Morrison.
Peter Milligan, I think.
Yeah, I think Peter got it instead of me. I'm not even sure I was second or third place in that. I tried out to write the Thor series, a couple of things, but I was always sort of in second place kind of thing. So, I was always interested in novels. I'd written a novel for my senior thesis, and I think I self-published my first novel. I'm not quite sure. I did Making God as a self-published book. It was something I'd written before, rewrote it, and hoped that my notoriety from The X-Files would get it some attention. And it was reviewed favorably in Publishers Weekly, but didn't do much in terms of the sales. And while I was still writing The X-Files, I did one of my favorite comics, which is The Bandy Man, for Caliber Press, and got Charlie, Moran, and Jill to do different sections of it.
Oh, so it was basically like a collaborative sort of mixtape effort almost.
Yeah, it was a story about a variation on the Genesis myth that I kind of made up along Gnostic lines, where God tried to create man but then didn't finish him and left this other unfinished version of man around. So the middle section is drawn. The middle section that tells that Genesis story is done by Moran Kim. There's a section set in ancient Judea about the woman who wrote the myth, done by Jill Thompson. And then there's a present day story done by where the art's done by Charlie. And they mix together very nicely. That's probably the comic book I'm proudest of overall. But you were asking about prose. Sometime after that, I was at a small horror writers convention boondoggle thing. It was a weekend where everybody just basically got drunk up in Rhode Island, and I was introduced to a young adult editor, and young adult was getting very big at the time. So she asked me for pitches, and I came up with five ideas for young adult novels, and just for the hell of it, I was thinking they'll never accept this one, but I threw in a variation on my Squalor comic book called Time Tripper. And that's the one they decided to give me a contract for. And so after that, I did the four Time Tripper books. And I also did some gaming titles for like White Wolf, based on their Vampire Masquerade series, or rather the Dark Ages one. Those were fun. And then, continued doing some young adult stuff with Teen Incorporated. That was almost a movie, almost a TV show. A couple of others for Walker Press, Rule of One. I mean, there's like 20 of them.
No worries. And I mean, I think that at the moment Dead Man Walking has been optioned.
Dead Man Walking and Dead Man Running, more recent. Very proud of those as well. I did kind of a combination noir zombie thing, which has sort of been done before, but I think I had a pretty unique take on it. And Simon Barry picked that up to try to do as a TV series. Simon Barry did Ghost Wars and Van Helsing and Quantum, I think, was his first. He always does really interesting variations on genre that I like a lot. And he did a terrific pilot script, and it was almost picked up by CBS, and now he's still pitching it in various places, so that's something I keep my fingers crossed on. The other big one was my young adult thriller, Ripper, which was actually based on the idea that Jack the Ripper went to the United States after the Whitechapel murders and had a son in between. So it's about the son's adventures in kind of a quasi-steampunk way. So that's still around and out there. And I stayed in comics through Jim when he went over to Paper Cuts and did the Nancy Drew graphic novels. There were 23 of those. So it's been, I've done all sorts of stuff.
Got like a very, 20, very career.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 20 books around.
And you teach writing as well. I think you teach it online at the University of Massachusetts as well, I believe.
Yes. I always wanted to teach, but I primarily got into that because all those books weren't paying very well. And I teach two online classes through UMass and recorded a series of video lectures for them. One is Writing for a Living, and the other, Writing the Graphic Novel, which I'm recording video lectures for now.
Oh, perfect.
And you can actually also buy them through the website Udemy, I think, for $20 gets you all 11 lectures.
The whole set, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, actually, just generally speaking, in terms of your output, because it was only when you mentioned like the Bandyman there and Gnosticism and stuff like that. Gnosticism seems to be a big recurring theme, particularly with regards to religion. I mean, I feel bad that it only really clicked there when you said it there, but it also plays through your X-Files work as well. Is it something that was conscious when you were writing? Because, I mean, obviously, like, Not to Be Open until Xmas, your very first issue, is about, I think, the prophecies of Fatima and stuff like that. And then, obviously, you have, like, the Gnosticism through, like, this world being real and all this sort of material as well. Like, was it a conscious thing? What is it about Gnosticism that sort of appeals to you as a subject matter, as a piece of, like, as something to write about?
Oh, Gnosticism. I thought you were saying narcissism, and I'm thinking Trump.
Oh, no. Yeah, I feel like I just dropped that in at the end of the interview. No, sorry, Gnosticism.
No. It's me. I did say Gnosticism, and then I remembered I said it, but I hadn't remembered it when you brought up narcissism. Okay, so is that Gnosticism? Is, you know, to recap, the basic theme is that, which is narcissistic, that we're, the world itself is an illusion, created by, you know, some version of Satan, but we all have these little sparks inside us that still connect us to the divine. And the path to the divine along those lines means rejecting the world, rejecting sexuality, rejecting materialism. It's a theme. It started way back, probably around the same time as Christianity. It may have preceded it. And it's just, you see it again in the Puritans, in their their attitude towards sex and the xenophobia. And I said it was narcissistic because it implies that there's something inside of you that's better than what you're, or more, or superior to what you're experiencing. I mean, I think the whole idea of making God human in human form is a form of narcissism. Seeing a light in the sky and assuming that someone's piloting it is also narcissism. Oh, no one could have a ship if they weren't like us and building things. That I think taints, taints. You know, sometimes it's correct. That influences the way we think about all sorts of things. So yeah, that was a very conscious theme that I very explicitly explored in The Bandyman. But it's something, you know, it's related to memory and how arrogant we are that we connect, that we think we do connect to reality strongly. But it's also fear-based because we have to connect to reality, or at least think we do, in order to survive. And that kind of tension, I think, is at root, certainly in a lot of American culture, United States culture to be specific, and a lot of literature and a lot of how we define, you know, what character is and what our conflicts are, as opposed to, I don't know, something more far Eastern, where individuality is less of an issue in some ways, and it's more about
collective,
sort of,
yeah,
you know, the role in society, the collective, so to speak.
All right, well, thank thank you very much, Stefan, for taking time out to talk about sure. your work. Actually, it's been a huge pleasure, and it's been fantastic, like, hearing you talk about and discuss it, sort of get a peek behind, like, how it was written and how, you know, some of the stuff I thought was there. It's always reassuring when you have, like, a crazy, you know, kind of read of it, and you're like, actually, I got what was there, which is very cool as well. So thank you very much for taking the time out.
Great. I hope I was coherent.
More than I suspect you're more coherent than I was. In the meantime, Tony will probably be back quite soon. And remember, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support the X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at IAmWillAye.